This is Mike Richardson, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 1st of May 2012. Mike Richardson, Part 2.
Did you ever fear for your life in the Antarctic? Any scary moments?
Yes. I mean, on the whole, I thought it was actually quite a benign environment, but of course it isn't. There were two occasions when we did things that, on reflection, we should not have done. One was climbing and one was boating. And, you know, you can get caught out. We were, I think it must have been very early 73. And the sea ice had just gone from Bourges Bay. And it was a beautiful day. It was one of these absolutely windless, bright, sunny, absolute stunning days. And we were laying a mooring right across the other side of Bourges Bay. So, in fact, the mooring was going to consist of a concrete-filled 45-gallon oil drum. And we'd built a raft specifically for this so that the drum was suspended just underneath this raft. And there we were, lovely day, Paul Skilling and I, in typical Fid shirts. You know, my Fid shirt normally used to resemble sort of rags sort of hanging off me, jeans and waders. That was it. It was such a beautiful day. But, of course, the water temperature was still probably about, you know, minus 1.8. The sea ice had only just gone. Anyway, just as we cut mooring free from the raft, one of the ropes snagged around the rollock of our 16-foot dinghy, and it promptly flipped. So by now, we've gone from a lovely day where we hadn't a care in the world, and we're sitting on an upturned boat that is actually sort of awash. It's almost below the surface of the water, wondering what to do. And we didn't have very long to worry about it, because we thought we'd better get the hell out of there pretty rapidly. And so we just took our waders off and swam for it. We reckoned we were about 60 yards from shore. And I remember I was quite conscious of the fact that I was just going unconscious when, in fact, one of my feet touched the shore. And quite frankly, it goes back to me being a lousy swimmer. I wasn't really up to anything else. Paul, on the other hand, who was our professional diver, very strong swimmer, he then ran back to base right the way round the whole of Bourges Bay in his stocking feet, losing a sock en route, going across a glacier to actually raise the alarm at base. And in fact, they then came and picked me up in the boat. And later on that day, we then went and dived on the boat and retrieved all our equipment, including cameras, from the bottom of the sea. And I always remember it took quite a long time to... I had to basically do quite a lot of work on my dear old Minolta, shoved it in a bucket of fresh water, then some alcohol, and then shocked it back to life again with a voltmeter, and it kept working for another 2 years. But I did realise that I think if that incident had happened another 30 yards offshore, I don't think... I certainly would have just literally passed out. I remember always that it would have been quite a euphoric way to go, because it was just literally so cold. It wasn't painful. The interesting thing was that Paul and I had completely different physiques, but we came up in bruising, which was almost identical, such that if you stood us side by side, we had massive bruising all over those parts of your body. So what you were doing was, you were desperately trying to swim very, very rapidly. And at the same time, your body presumably was trying to withdraw all the blood into your core. So everything was rupturing. So all over our biceps, thighs, back muscles and so on, we had this massive bruising. And I say, we looked like a pair of twins. And I took months to regain any sensitivity in my fingers, literally months from that episode, which, okay, turned out all right, but actually could have been a tragedy. And the other instance was sort of similar insofar as it was a fantastic day. We'd gone over to Coronation Island, I think three of us, And this is winter. And we'd gone to Shingle Cove. And then Jerry Light turns up. Now, Jerry was, you know, his ex-instructor from Glenmore Lodge in the Cairngorms. And Jerry turned up, and it was such a lovely day. He said, well, why don't we go for a climb up that ridge? So we said, oh, well, OK, fine. Now, we were all completely inexperienced. And again, you know, it was a fantastic day, and we were all dressed completely inappropriately for going climbing. I mean, we were literally in shirt sleeves, etc. Anyway, we got towards the top of this ridge when suddenly the very characteristic fern cloud that you get over Coronation started suddenly to appear. And I think Jerry was sufficiently experienced. He realised, you know, we'd better get off this ridge very rapidly. And we started going down, and the wind speed went up from effectively zero to about 70 knots within literally minutes, certainly about half an hour. And when we got back to base and looked at the temperature record, we saw that the temperature dropped by about 40 degrees within an hour. Anyway, we roped up. We were going back over this ice field, and we realised that we were not going to make, actually, Shingle Cove and the hut at Shingle. So we had to dig in. The trouble was, we hadn't got any spades. We'd only got ice axes, and we hit ice about 3 feet down. So whatever snow hole we could dig was basically like a shallow... We hollowed out effectively a sort of shallow concavity under the snow, and we all sort of got in there, but we couldn't even get our feet in. I mean, our boots were sticking out all night, and all our equipment. And again, I think if we hadn't, we just spent the night in there, and I think if we hadn't dug in then, I don't think we would have survived actually.
You were base commander for both those incidents.
No, so. Jerry was base commander at that particular
for the
time.
The first one. For the first one.
No, I was the base commander when we managed to upturn the boat.
Okay. The what passed for health and safety in those days was really just personal experience being passed on from one season of fish.
Yeah,
to
I
the
think
next.
In those situations you could say personal inexperience. But
well, was anything? Did that become part of the base folklore that you don't do that?
Well,
because he nearly died. In other words, were there lessons learnt that could be passed on
well,
to the next generation?
Well, they weren't sort of... there wasn't even a sort of log, as far as I recall, where you'd actually write these things down in terms of formalising such incidents. I mean, they, happily I say, didn't end in tragedy or injury. Could have. I mean, just before I had arrived on base, was it three of the guys had actually taken the dear old Desmarestia, which is our 16-foot clinker dinghy. I mean, they'd... Again, the ice had only just gone, and three of them, I think it was Ian Raybarts, Owen Darling, and the diesel mechanic at the time. I mean, they'd gone off to Orcadas, the Argentine base on Lorry Island. Well, that must be about 25, 30 miles away, you know, in an open 16-foot boat. I mean, they'd taken all the gear. They'd taken a number of engines and amount of fuel and all this sort of stuff. Even so, and I think they went for about a fortnight. And the Argies were absolutely amazed when, I think there was a guy, somebody said, oh, when they turned up, the place was deserted except there was one guy wandering around outside. He clearly then heard, you know, the noise of an outboard engine. And the dear old Argies at Orcadas were absolutely amazed to get a visitation from three Brits turning up in a little 16-foot wooden dinghy. But no, I mean, I think London did hear of... London certainly heard of that instance and sent a sharp note down to base saying such travels were not to be repeated. But on the whole, some of these things were never actually got as far as London or Stanley, I think. And there was no actual formal record kept on base as to these sort of near misses, you could say.
In retrospect, is that something you know... have sleepless nights about
it? Well, not really.
Close calls? No, perhaps not sleepless nights, but is it something you now think, yeah, actually, knowing what I know now, we would never have done that in the first place?
Oh, well, yeah, but, I mean, you know, the boating accident was an accident. I mean, it should have gone smoothly. It didn't by a mistake of just...
But you weren't equipped?
No, we weren't. No, we weren't. We probably should have been in, you know, survival suits or something on a boiling hot day.
Today you would be, I guess.
Well, today, yeah. Well, I think it's probably swung the other way, where basically, you know, you can hardly move for health and safety. I mean, actually, Health and Safety Act didn't come in until years later, and I was by then working for the Nature Conservancy Council in Shetland. I always remember when the Health and Safety at Work Act came in, and we got a note from, you know, Edinburgh or whatever it was, saying we were now entitled to have protective clothing. Well, I actually wrote back with one of my facetious responses saying, well, thank you very much. I actually have all my own protective clothing in terms of anoraks, boots, hats, etc. What I actually could really do with is a suit to protect me from the bureaucrats. I don't think that went down too well in Edinburgh.
Let's take you to the North Shetlands, for want of a better description, because you sailed back out of the Antarctic again in 73, I think.
73, yeah.
And then landed this job in Shetland.
Well, that was 2 years later, because basically I spent 2 years. I had to go back to Durham. Durham required at that time that you spend a year in residence in the university to qualify for, you know, PhD. And so I spent another year at Monk's Wood, which was quite funny.
Why was it funny?
Well, Eric Twells, ex-base commander before Jerry Light, was still there. And I stayed with Eric and his wife, Jane, for a while, who lived at... just down the road, I can't remember now. Anyway, Eric and I used to basically terrorise Monk's Wood. Monk's Wood was actually a national nature reserve. And they had just spent many thousands of pounds erecting a fence around the wood to keep, I think, the rabbits out or something. And Eric and I religiously went round this fence and chopped holes in it at about 20-yard intervals so that when the farmer started combining his corn... all the pheasants that were in it all ran through the fence and were promptly caught in our traps. And basically, Eric used to go around every night virtually and blow pheasants out of the branches in this National Nature Reserve. And I'd also got ferrets. And I remember one morning, Dick Laws had us in and said, the director of the Institute wants to see you two. And that was Sir Kenneth Mellenby. So we went in to see Mellenby, and he said, gentlemen, could I remind you that this is a national nature reserve, and you don't seem to be doing too much beneficial for the nature at the moment, so could you desist? So that was my time at Monk's Wood. I then went up to Durham, and then I'd applied for this job for the Nature Conservancy Council. The then Nature Conservancy Council, since disbanded, for assistant regional officer's job in the northwest of Scotland. It would have been covering the whole of the northwest of Scotland. And Jerry Light had also applied, and actually unbeknown to me, Peter Tilbrook, who was the head of terrestrial life sciences in Bass, had also applied to the Nature Conservancy Council. Well, I got a note back from Edinburgh saying they would definitely like to have me for interview, so I thought, well, that's fine. And then sometime later, Jerry came in and said, oh, I've got an interview in Edinburgh on Monday. So I rang up this woman in the Nature Conservancy Council and said, well, where's my interview? And she came back a few minutes later and said, I'm terribly sorry, but you haven't been shortlisted. So I sent her a fax which indicated, you know, which relayed back to her that I was going to be invited to interview. And she came back and said, oh, I was terribly sorry, I was reading the wrong list. Well, obviously, they must have been reading the wrong list all the time. Anyway, the long and short of it was that actually I got offered a job. Jerry didn't. Peter Tilbrook went to become the deputy regional officer in northwest Scotland. And they rang me up and said, Terry, sorry, you haven't got the job dealing with the northwest of Scotland, but would you like to go? We've got a similar job in Orkney and Shetland. And I said, well, can I get back to you? And I went home that night and I was desperately scrabbling around trying to find a map of any description that would actually show Shetland and Orkney not in the Murray Firth. And, of course, they didn't exist in those days, so I had no idea where it was. I mean, it sounds terribly naive. But, of course, Shetland, you know, is 200 miles from Aberdeen. And I went up for a recce in the June of 1975 and took the job in September that year. So I was actually the sole representative of the Nature Conservancy Council at that time, covering both of the Northern Isles. So I used to commute between Shetland and Orkney virtually on a weekly basis.
It was just one man?
Yeah, it was a one-man band. They increased it by another man in 1978, just at the time when we had a major oil spill in Shetland. And by the time I left, I think I probably had about six or seven staff in Shetland and about five in Orkney.
Did any of the skills you picked up in the Antarctic come in handy in Shetland and Orkney?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a funny thing that, and it's not just that progression going from. I mean, the reason I'd actually gone for the Nature Conservancy Council job was that I sort of realised, and you asked me earlier, did I make any stunning sort of
discoveries
in terms of science? And the answer probably is no. They were probably relatively mundane, but they would have been novel. But I did come to the conclusion that I wanted to be a biologist, but I didn't necessarily want to just do pure science and look at the sort of, you know, the left leg of a shrimp for the next, you know, 40 years or something. I wanted to do something more practical, which is why I actually joined, you know, wanted to do practical nature conservation. And certainly some of the things that I picked up in the Antarctic assisted the Nature Conservancy Council's job. And undoubtedly, many of the things I dealt with the NCC were to be useful when I finally went back to Antarctic work at the international diplomatic level.
You started a family in Sheffield.
Yeah, well, at that time, just as we moved to Shetland, oil was just hitting the scene, and there was a tremendous, pressure on housing. We rented a little croft house right at the end of the south end of Borough. Delightful spot, and it wasn't very long before we started a family, but we didn't quite know what we were in for, because it was almost the stage of like lambing. And my wife, who was, well, very pregnant, but what we didn't realise until she'd actually given birth to one, and the doctor suddenly grabbed a stethoscope and said, "Oh my God, there's another one in here," we didn't realise we were going to get twins. So what was our little croft house also doubled up for the Nature Conservancy Council's office, and also was effectively the nursery, and also when it rained, the rain came in through the roof, so we had cots and buckets strategically placed around the floor. So it was actually quite a... And, of course, the job was, almost... it was endless. I mean, you could have done it 25 hours a day and 8 days a week, and you still wouldn't have, really done what you wanted to do. But it was just one of those sorts of jobs. But it was a great, great place to bring up kids, great place to live. The job was fantastic. And even by the time I got many more staff, I always had a very, very simple philosophy with the job, which I always used to just say to my staff is, well, we know what they want in Aberdeen, so we'll just give them three times more than they expect, in which case they'll keep away from us, which then enabled us to do fantastic sort of field work. So as long as you delivered all the paperwork that they were expecting, we would then clear off and go and, you know, count kittiwakes for 3 weeks or tag seals or do something useful. And it was a great job because it did actually encompass everything from very practical biology and nature conservation through to all the bureaucratic side of conservation, which is dealing with planning applications and, you know, the fishing industry and the aquaculture industry and the farming industry and the oil industry. And actually, for the first 10 years of my time in Shetland, oil was the dominant factor because North Sea oil was really just hitting the scene. They were building the huge oil terminal at Sullivo in Shetland, which at that time was the biggest civil engineering project in Europe. There was the other oil terminal being built at Flotter in Orkney, and so the politics of oil was very much to the forefront at that time.
How do you mean? I mean, were you on behalf of the Nature Conservancy Council? Were you having to sort of fight some kind of rear guard action against?
Well, you're not fighting a rear guard action. What you're trying to do, because the decisions had been taken.
But you're still trying to protect.
Yeah, but the decisions had been taken that oil was going to come ashore in Shetland, etc., etc. It was going to be massive. I mean, at the height of production of throughput for Sullivo, that terminal was taking the equivalent of about 75% of British oil consumption. It wasn't actually necessarily coming to the domestic market. A lot of it was going to the States, but it gives you an idea of the throughput of that terminal at that time. It was very significant. And what you're trying to do is to minimise the impact of what is an inevitable development, because the decisions have been taken. The decisions have been taken in in Whitehall, you know, in London, in Parliament. I mean, you know, major acts of Parliament had been passed in terms of the Zetland County Council Act, which gave the local authority in Orkney, well, Orkney as well, passed legislation. So all those principal decisions have been taken. What you're then faced with is making sure, through contingency planning, et cetera, that the impacts of oil are minimised. And what is interesting, actually, is that I was very, very closely associated with an organisation that was set up, which was an organisation composed of central government, local government, the oil companies, all the statutory agencies, the environmental NGOs and so on, which was called the Shetland Oil Terminal Environmental Advisory Group. What I found interesting is that 20-odd years later, I'm actually now the chairman of that group. I mean, I thought it was a bit bizarre because after I left the Foreign Office, I suddenly got a call saying, would I take on the chairmanship of this organisation? I said, well, you know, it's 20 years since I was actually involved in Shetland. They said, yes, but actually there's probably no one else knows the Shetland environment better than you. And the politics better than you. So despite that time lag, so I now find myself returning to work that I was involved in the 70s and 80s.
Was anything at that time, in the boom time of the 70s, nobody quite realised how long the oil would last for? But now we know he's got a finite life expectancy and he's going to start drying up in due course. Any of the planning that took place then, was that taking into account that actually what was really happening was a temporary measure?
Well, yeah, but I mean, of course, it was, you know, we took a very, we as the UK and the Thatcher government at that time took a very different approach to oil than, say, the Norwegians. The Norwegians take a view that, well, let's keep a lot of it in the ground. And Norwegian oil exploration and exploitation is almost characterised by how much they haven't taken out of the ground, whereas actually at that time, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a desire in the UK for, you know, balance of payments or whatever to, you know, get it out and sell it off. Yes, I mean, the throughput of oil, particularly coming from the East Shetland Basin, and let's say the big fields like the Brent and Ninian fields, has decreased very, very considerably. But, of course, what's happening now is tremendous developments and exploration going on in the very deep water and very rough water to the west of Shetland. I'm talking about very deep water. And so you've got oil and gas fields coming on stream now, which also are starting to feed into Sullom Voe. So, for example, Lagan Tormore, which is being developed by Total, that will feed into Shetland in another 2 years' time, and it'll have major gas pipelines coming into Shetland where the gas will be processed and then fired off down through another pipeline to Scottish mainland. So you're seeing a progression in oil development with fields diminishing, even closing down. Of course, what happens is the technology improves. So fields and, of course, the economics of oil change. So as you know, with oil, the price it is now, it then becomes economic to go back and redevelop fields. And, of course, there's new technology. So what you couldn't get out 20 or 30 years ago, with new technologies you can. And fields that were non-viable some time ago become then viable.
Is there anything that happened when you worked with the Nature Conservancy Council that you really, really regret, things that you couldn't stop from happening?
Well,
in the oil business, I mean.
Well, we had a... We had spent 5 years drawing up contingency plans for oil spills, both around Shetland generally and particularly for around the Sullom Voe area. And I was intimately involved in those. And all our planning was predicated around North Sea oil, i.e. the stuff that was coming into Sullom Voe. So we knew all about the physical and chemical properties of Brent and Ninian crude. And within 3 weeks of Sullom Voe opening, we then had a very, very substantial oil spill, but it wasn't of North Sea oil. It was a tanker. This was New Year's Eve. Brilliant. It was New Year's Eve. It was blowing absolute hooly. It was blizzarding. It's Shetland. It's dark. It's the middle of winter. It's New Year's Eve. There's no one around. Nothing works. And as they were berthing a tanker, one of the tugs, they were berthing it with three tugs, one of the tugs caught fire in its engine room and released its tow. The tanker swung and crashed into the mooring dolphins and actually ruptured its own fuel tanks. And we had a massive, massive oil spill of heavy bunker C going into Sullombo in January, you know, very cold waters. And that was one hell of a mess. But interesting, and it caused a phenomenal amount of damage. In some ways, in the long run, it was almost a godsend, because I'm not saying that the oil industry is complacent. We had spent, you know, sitting down with the oil companies, we spent a lot of time doing contingency planning. But there's nothing like contingency planning when the reality suddenly hits, because suddenly you realise that all the things you thought you had in place actually don't work. Mm. And so after that spill, the issues that were put in place in Shetland were infinitely tougher than they would have been. So that spill was environmentally quite horrendous, killed a lot of wildlife. But the ramifications of that, which you now still see today, are still there. I mean, there was it tightened up the whole attitude towards oil spill contingency planning.
The reason why I'm pursuing this line of inquiry is, of course, that we're going to see something very similar happening in the Falklands in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I find the Falklands situation... I mean, I have... Because I was, until fairly recently, a trustee of Falklands Conservation, I was also... And although I resigned from a trustee of Falklands Conservation, they sort of said to me, well, yes, but can you still be our sort of oil expert? And if we have issues that we want to discuss, can we come to you for advice on oil? The thing that I've still bemused about in relation to Falklands oil, and it's part of this Falklands situation that you still see, it's always been there as far as I can see, is this parochialness. The Falklands have never really wanted, you could say, incomers. Mm. Shetland embraced oil, but controlled it. Shetland was ruthless in how it controlled the oil industry. They didn't just march in and say, we're here. Shetland basically set the rules, and they were very tough rules. And economically, Shetland has made an enormous amount of money and benefit out of oil. Now, the Falklands Islands, because they don't want oil ashore, they don't want anybody, quite frankly. They think that it can be dealt with wholly offshore and remote. Now, that's fine if you've got a hinterland, if I can put it that way, that you can rely on. In other words, in the same way as most North Sea oil developments are operating out of Aberdeen or Montrose or wherever, and there's an awful lot of money to be made out of not just the oil industry per se, but all oil-related activities, including waste disposal. But if you were relying on a support for Falklands oil coming from Montevideo or Argentina or somewhere, fine. But to do it remotely, I can't see how it will really work. Now, the mechanism I've seen for Falklands oil would be very similar, or seems to be similar, to the way that, for example, the Schiehallion field west of Shetland works. And Schiehallion basically has a subsea mechanism sending oil up to a floating, it's effectively like a floating tanker, and you then have a shuttle tanker taking oil from that to Sullombo. But in Shetland, that shuttle tanker's going twice a week. But in the Falklands, where you have no support from South America, your shuttle mechanism is going to be weeks or months. So that, to me, would suggest that the economics are all completely different. I don't know how it will work. But I don't know. I've always thought, you know, even post the Falklands conflict, if they had actually willingly embraced increasing their population, which they didn't, actually politically would have been to their benefit. It's actually far easier to justify defending 20,000 people than two or three.
So the Falklanders don't want the oil on their shore, therefore they don't want the development that goes with it. They don't want the housing and the affluence that goes...
Well, but even with the fishing, I mean, I was very closely associated with the fishing industry in the Falklands because I, you know, used to be closely involved with the organisation which was called the South Atlantic Fisheries Commission, which was a bilateral commission with Argentina. where we used to meet twice a year, alternating between Buenos Aires and London. But if you actually look at the way that the Falklands has handled their fishing industry, they've made a lot of money out of it, but actually it's the least amount of money they could have made out of it, insofar as what they are effectively doing is little more than selling licences, often to either foreign fishing companies or to joint ownership mechanisms, with largely with Spain, say. Whereas what they don't do is put any added value to their fishing. In other words, actually bring the product ashore and process it, in which case you would make an awful lot more money. But of course, they make the point that they actually haven't got the employment. They haven't got actually the personnel to do that. So there are no fish factories or anything in the Falklands. So it's a remote operation. They sort of want it but don't want it.
That's going to change, isn't it? I mean,
it hasn't changed even since 82.
The British Exchequer needs money out of the Falklands to reverse the decline.
Well, I mean, you know, I think they're still some time away from actually really working out how they're going to deal with this stuff.
Hmm.
I mean, to give you some idea of what happened in Shetland, I mean, because you did have an onshore facility and all the things that go with it, I mean, even building that facility, you had work camps that were occupied by up to 6,000 construction workers. But, you know, and since Shetland only had a population of 22,000, that's quite an influx. But it hasn't been detrimental to Shetland at all. You know, I think, I say, Shetlanders were very outgoing and embraced it and controlled it. And it's very difficult to actually operate a very big industry like that without realising that there are repercussions of all sorts. But
so the ostrich has its head in the sand?
Well, I think so. I don't think they've really thought it through yet as to how they think they're going to actually operate.
They've got time, of course. It'll be a few years, yeah.
Yes, I mean, you know, but not that much time. I mean, from between finding oil and economically bringing it ashore or wherever would be about 10 years at most, but between 5 and 10 years.
Thank you for that. We will spend the next half hour talking about the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, if I may. Strange commute from Lerwick to Whitehall. How did it affect the family?
Well, it affected all of us, I think. If I went back, when I went home that time in 1975 and basically pronounced to my wife that we were leaving Cambridgeshire and we were going to this place in Shetland to take up a new job, I think I nearly got a divorce. 15 years later, when I suggested we were going to go from Shetland and I was taking up a job in London, I nearly got a divorce again because, you know, we'd brought up the three kids in this amazing environment in Shetland. My wife was very heavily embedded in the local community. I mean, she ran the playgroup and she ran the brownies and she ran everything. So it was, well, it was a major change for all of us. I mean, the twins by then were about 12 or 13, so it was...
Speaking with a Scottish accent, I guess?
They spoke absolute, well, not a Scottish accent, they spoke absolute broad Shetland, which even... I was up in Aberdeen a few weeks ago, and an Aberdeen taxi driver, when he realised I used to live in Shetland, he said, well, I can't understand those guys at all. So, because it is... I mean, Shetland is... Well, Orcadian is very different. You know, Orcadian is very sing-songy with Scottish words, you could say. It's almost like Welsh. Listen to it, it's almost like Welsh intonation with Scottish words. Shetland is something else. You know, it's a dialect which is sort of drawn from almost Dutch, Germanic, Scottish, Norwegian. I mean, it's an old English. You know, they never use the word you, or very rarely. It's always thee, thou, thine, or they'll use you as ist du coming, you know. It's a very, very strong dialect.
So how did the children cope at school then when they came to London?
Well, we actually moved down to Sussex. my youngest, who really did speak broad Shetland, I mean, he didn't speak English. I think, luckily, he wasn't a sort of lad that was going to get bullied. They actually thought he was a bit of a sort of just an odd peculiarity. I mean, they couldn't understand him for a while. But he joined the local school football team. And that group of kids I mean, he was then 7 or 8, are still, there's this unbelievable group of mates who are now sort of late 20s or just about 30. They're still as strong as could be. But yeah, it was a major, major economic, social and professional switch in life.
Does he still speak?
No, no, they lost that within about, they lost that within about 18 months. It was quite interesting.
So talk about your new role, your new pinstripe suit, bowler hat, furled umbrella, briefcase. What were you going to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to do?
Well, it's rather like, you know, I mean, it's a funny sort of career progression to go from Bass to the Nature Conservancy Council and then end up literally overlooking the Cenotaph. And, you know, I said earlier that I decided to leave Bass and go for the Nature Conservancy Council because I didn't really want to look at the left leg of a shrimp for the rest of my life. And I was always trying to persuade my staff in the NCC to, you know, think beyond the immediate horizons. And a lot of them did. And, you know, guys that used to work for me are now sort of directors of WWF in Canada or whatever it is. Anyway, it was a Thursday afternoon and one of my staff just sauntered into my office and tossed this advert in front of me in New Scientist and said, there you are, there's a job absolutely designed for you, which was, in fact, the then deputy head of what was the Polar Region section in the Foreign Office. So I applied and I didn't think very much of it. And I got then an interview and got hauled down to the Civil Service Commission in Whitehall. And the funny thing was, and who do I meet in the interview room? Who had interviewed me in 1970? But one Dick Laws, you see. He said, oh, it's you again, is it? And as I walked out of the interview room, I ran straight into Inigo Everson, who used to be my boss, two removed, because Inigo was at that time, when I first joined Bass, head of marine life sciences in Bass. And Inigo sort of looked at me, I mean, we're very great friends, and said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, probably the same as you, Inigo. Anyway, I got the job. And yes, it's a bit different going from sort of, you know, wearing an old tatty barber and steel-toed Wellington boots, wandering around Shetland, to suddenly discovering you're commuting into London in a pinstripe suit. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I mean, you know, I sort of felt I needed a challenge, a new challenge. And although the working existence was very different, actually many of the things that I was dealing with in the international polar scene were things that I dealt with simply on a local basis in Shetland. So they were, you know, the actual working agenda wasn't that different.
Just the scale.
The scale, completely different. And of course, I'd never been involved in international meetings at all. I'd been to one on the island of Ushant Dueysant. I'd gone to an international meeting about island communities. That was the only exposure I'd ever had to an international meeting. And then suddenly you get pitched out, you know, pitched up in London, and you're supposed to be fronting up, you know, the Union flag at an international meeting.
Well, there were two significant international bodies who had meetings that you had to get yourself acquainted with. One was CAMLAR, and the other was the Antarctic Treaty. Am I right in thinking that?
That's right. Well, my job initially was to understudy John Heap, who was then the head of the Polar Regions section in the Foreign Office. And by the time I took over from him in two years after that, when he retired, there had only been, so in 1992... there had only been three heads of the Polar Region section in the Foreign Office since 1943. So the UK had this tradition of long institutional memory dealing with the political side of the Antarctic, which actually has always stood the UK in very good stead. And yes, I mean, by the time I took over, my principal responsibilities in terms of providing ministers with advice on the polar regions generally was to head up the consultative meetings of the Antarctic Treaty Parties and also the Antarctic Fisheries Commission, CAMLAR.
Before we get on to that, just tell me a bit more about John Heap. What sort of guy was he? Both as somebody you knew privately and also as your immediate...
Well, of course, I didn't know him at all. I didn't know him at all. I knew him by reputation. And I turned up, before I actually started the job, on the 2nd of January 1990... John invited me down just for a day, just to talk things over, and I stayed with him one night. just near Cambridge, Harston. And he picked me up in his car. And within 5 minutes, he said to me, well, of course, you're working for an outfit, i.e. the Foreign Office, which is completely staffed with people who know absolutely nothing about anything. They're all generalists, and you will be one of the very few specialists in the Foreign Office. That's what you're supposed to be. But John was he'd been doing the job for a very long time, and he was a wonderful tutor. I mean, effectively, I was understudying it was a deliberate understudy for 2 years up to when he was going to retire.
Succession planning.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. Sort of thing that Foreign Office doesn't normally do. The Foreign Office normally, if you have 3 days of handover, you're lucky. And John was just a wonderful tutor, but the best way of understudying him was to see him in action. And he was just a past master. He said to me one day, I'll just go back. The first day I turned up in the Foreign Office, I say, was the 2nd of January, and John grilled me all morning. And then he said, I think we'll go for a lunch. And we ended up in this little wine bar up near Leicester Square, happens to be next to the sex shop. And I could never find this wine bar unless I looked for the sex shop. And we had 2 bottles of wine, and then we were on to the third. And I thought, I hope it's not like this every day. I mean, when I came out of there, I would barely be able to feed the squirrels in St. James's Park, never mind think. But John basically said to me, well, it's all very simple, really. He said, international meetings. He said, there's just really only 3 rules. One is that it's got to be your paper they're discussing on the table, not somebody else's. 2, you've got to know more about the issue than anybody else in the room, and you've got to be absolutely briefed. And he said, and after that, it's just pure theatre. And that's where, you know, it used to be so brilliant watching him, because he'd sit there and then he'd suddenly say, well, I need hardly remind the meeting of the decision that we took in 1952 in respect of whatever it was. And of course, everybody else in the room would just sort of sit there mesmerised, have no idea what the hell we decided in 1952 or something. And he would just play this game, and he could do it very well. And of course, he could out-negotiate virtually anybody else in that room with these various ploys, and it was brilliant to watch. I think I probably inherited a degree of it.
So that actually made your christening rather more difficult, because you hadn't been there since 1952. You were coming in.
No, I remember
a rare new boy.
No, I remember various people. I remember the director of the Norwegian Polar Institute saying to me, he said, "Well, you know, you've got very large boots to fill."
Yeah.
And you know, it sort of slightly worried me, but actually, after a few years, people were saying to me, well, John Heap was very good, but actually you seem to be almost better. And by then, the agenda had become even more complicated. I mean, I don't say that about myself. It's just simply other people had said to me, and I was a bit slightly surprised, because I just sort of feel I just do the job.
There's a lovely story which I wanted to tell me about some backroom diplomacy which took place in Oslo.
Well, yes, it was. I hadn't been in the Foreign Office very long, so I joined in January. And there was to be a meeting in Oslo. And it wasn't actually an international meeting as such. It wasn't a diplomatic meeting. It was actually more of an academic. Well, it was an academic, what I mean is political science meeting. And we were meeting in the Oslo Plaza, a big hotel. So it wasn't a meeting of governments. It was a meeting of academics and policymakers and all sorts of things.
This is 1990.
This is 1990. And John Heap was extremely exercised at that time because, now this is the time, you have to realise, they had just finished negotiations, 8 years negotiations of the Antarctic Minerals Convention, CRAMRA. And within months of signing that finally adopting the text of that Minerals Convention, it was all falling apart. Initially, it fell apart because the Australians and the French indicated they would not sign it. John was exercised, but as he said to me, I was, you know, totally new to all of this and completely, you know, wet behind the ears. And he said to me, well, don't worry about that too much. They might not, they say they're not going to sign it, but they can always join later. Then there was this crucial thing where the New Zealanders, who had signed it and would have been the depository state for CRAMRA, basically indicating they were not going to ratify it. And they indicated that at prime ministerial level, at which point it was dead. So by the time we went to... So that was late 1989. That was a time of tremendous stress within the Antarctic Treaty System because no one knew what was happening. No one knew what would happen next because suddenly the consensus that had been arrived at over 8 years of negotiation of CRAMRA had dissolved. And if you have no consensus, you have a free-for-all. And this was a great worry to John. Anyway, we turn up in Oslo, and as I say, I was very new to this game, and there was one evening where we were going to Oslo Castle for a evening reception with the Norwegian Foreign Minister in attendance. And John said to me just before then, he said, halfway through the reception, he said, we will just slip out. Don't make it obvious. We will just... We and a whole lot of other people will just sidle out, but not all together. So we sidled out. And lo and behold, all of these people who apparently sort of had mysteriously disappeared from this reception all reappeared around a table at a restaurant in downtown Oslo. And what really amazed me was there we were now around a dinner table. And halfway through dinner, John suddenly said, well, gentlemen, the reason I wanted to get together this evening is here is the text of a draft environmental protocol to the Antarctic Treaty, which I would like you to consider. And he literally just shoved this text around the table. And that was the... It was an amazing illustration of backroom diplomacy at work. What John put on the table then was very much a skeletal document, just first draft, but it was to prove to be the text that by the time we got to Viña del Mar in October or November of 1990, which was going to be the first negotiations of something, but no one actually knew what it was going to be, the Australians were promoting a conservation convention. And the problem would have been, as we saw it, was that a conservation convention, given that many of the things in the Antarctic Treaty System by now were becoming environmental, an actual convention would have possibly, in parallel, have eroded the Antarctic Treaty itself. The New Zealanders came forward with a very complex environmental protocol text, but the thing that actually won the day was our skeletal draft environmental protocol that John had first produced and had subsequently worked up that evening in Oslo. It was actually, I thought it was quite remarkable. And it was the UK text that was then developed further, actually largely by the Norwegian ambassador that joined that meeting. But there was about five, at that time in the Antarctic Treaty System, there was a little cabal. People would say not a healthy cabal, perhaps, but that cabal consisted of the heads of delegation of the UK, US, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, and France. It was a very tight-knit little sort of community.
And they all had respect for John Heap, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. Very much so. I remember when John retired, the Chileans wanted to give him some amazing national honour, but he couldn't actually accept it.
What, diplomatically?
Well, you know, I mean, he was held in very great respect by the Antarctic community.
Did you ever try and pull off anything, any stunts like that yourself?
Well, you're doing it all the time. Yes, I mean, you know, I learnt a lot from John, and you do it all the time. And the whole point about international diplomacy is it's not just what happens in a formal setting around a room with loads of flags. Actually, the art of it is what happens not in that room, mm-hmm. In the corridors and in, you know, backroom meetings, and sometimes meetings at ridiculous hours of the night, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning in some hotel room in Kyoto or something.
The same with everything, same with the cabinets,
yes.
And
yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I always remember the head of the New Zealand delegation at a Kamala meeting coming up to me, storming up to me, saying, literally sort of saying, I hate you, you're always talking to people. And I said, oh, just wise up. I said, that's what you're supposed to do.
So when you went back to the Antarctic in the late 90s, was it you went back again?
Well, I went down actually just as a sort of recce trip. John said, well, you know, get yourself back off down to the Antarctic, see how it's changed. That was 1992, and I was on the James Clark Ross, but I mean, I really didn't have much of an agenda. I was just going for a look-see, see how things had changed. And what was really interesting, actually, was, lo and behold, we turn up back at Signy. And it's a funny thing in life when, you know, in March 1973, when I left Signy, you have no idea at all that you're ever going to turn up again. And so we're heading towards Signy and the James Clark Ross, and someone said to me, well, A, what does it feel like going back? But they said, well, what's it look like? I said, well, actually, oddly enough, it's changed colour. I mean, Signy, basically, from a distance, is, except for the snow and ice, is grey. You know, it's largely schist rocks. And lo and behold, Signy had changed colour. By now, it was pale green. And the reason, largely, was because, I mean, when we were on base, and I was on base for, say, 2.5 years, I think in that time, if we saw 5 fur seals in 2.5 years, that was about it. By 1990, and particularly by the spring, or, you know, the sort of January period of 1990, I think there was something like 22,000 fur seals on Signy. Well, it's a very small island, and fur seals actually ruin the environment. You know, you're talking about the footprint we had. By now, you know, this number or density of animals has completely mangled the freshwater systems and the locks from their excreta. And you get this tremendous flush of praziola algae. So, in fact, Signy had changed colour. It was quite bizarre, really. But the base was also interesting because the one critical thing was that suddenly there were some women around. And we used to have big debates on base. I remember when we were there in the 70s about, you know, would this work? You know, we had a very, very harmonious existence for 2 winters on base. I can't even remember ever a serious argument or a row, ever. And we used to have these discussions about, well, if you threw a few women in here, what would happen? And the general consensus was that it was a thoroughly bad idea because clearly it wouldn't remain harmonious. And when I went back to Signy in, say, 1992, there were 2 or 3 women on base, scientists. There were some, as far as I can remember, there was 1 or 2 Dutch girls working on marine biology, algae. And it had changed the dynamics of the base, but had changed the dynamics for the good. You could see that straight away, and I thought that was very interesting.
You did have an agenda, though, when you went back in 1999 and 2005, because you were now involved in inspecting the huts, the bases.
Well, Antarctic Treaty, well, inspections under the Antarctic Treaty are one of the provisions that are written into the treaty. And when they were written in, it was all about, I mean, if you go back to the Treaty of 57, it was all about, there was great concerns that people would be doing things in Antarctica that they shouldn't be doing, particularly on the military side. So the actual principle of inspections was all geared around that. However, by the time you get post the introduction of the environmental protocol, Antarctic Treaty inspections have become much more environmental. They're almost like an environmental audit, in effect. And the UK has always been to the fore in conducting inspections. We have probably carried out more inspections than anyone else. And I was very keen to continue that. But I was also very keen to do it in association with other parties and in 2 ways. It didn't always work out. But what I really wanted to do was, A, to bring in third world parties, if you can call it that. So we were always trying to invite, you know, India or somewhere, someone to join us. The other thing is that there's a tremendous divide between East and West Antarctica. They barely talk to each other. So what happens on the, you know, in the Australian sector or something is completely different, or could be, from what happens on the peninsula. And I felt that a degree of you know, fertilisation of ideas and exposure of situations, one between the two, would be good. So we were always keen to carry out inspections in association. I mean, we were clearly leading the inspection team, but we wanted to do it in association with other parties. So in 1999, I teamed up with the Germans. It was actually an East German guy that came with me. So we had a German-UK inspection team. And then we did another one in 2005. Because the Argentines would always complain that we didn't speak Spanish. Initially, I'd taken, in fact, there was one in 1992 where we took an Italian who was fluent Spanish speaker, but still the Argentines complained. So in 2005, I teamed up with the Peruvians, I think it was Peruvians, and also with the Australians to try and, I say, do these two things of bringing some expertise in from the other side of Antarctica. And in both of those inspections in 1999 and 2005, I think we carried out more inspections of facilities, bases, historic sites, tourist ships than think anybody else had done before. I don't think there are actually many bases on the Antarctic that I haven't actually visited. And it's a very, very interesting process because you can see how each different state, you know, implements the environmental protocol. And you get to see more sewage treatment plants or generating rooms or mechanisms for removing waste disposal or whatever. You know, it's a very, very interesting process.
Did you ever find anything naughty going on?
Yes. Yes, we did. And
Can you give me an example?
Well, it's a means of exposing some of those. And you have to do it diplomatically because you don't want to totally embarrass these parties in front of the whole of the Antarctic Treaty System. But I mean, for example, when we first inspected Great Wall Base, the Chinese base just next to Bellingshausen, their fuel system was absolutely catastrophic. Their generator shed was absolutely diabolical. And in a polite language, I mean, we took photographs of this stuff. I mean, it was an oil spill of some magnitude waiting to happen. I mean, their pipework, their tankage, everything was just horrendous. It was interesting that when we got back in 2005, the generator shed at Great Wall was state of the art. Somebody had taken some notice, and there was a brand new generator shed with brand new generators in there. It was absolutely, you could have eaten your lunch off the floor in there. The pipage and the tank work were still woefully inadequate, and in fact, the buildings generally were woefully inadequate. The thing that really disappointed me in carrying out Antarctic Treaty inspections was actually the quality and the facility of science. That really got to me. I mean, you could go up and down the peninsula, and really, at the end of the day, very few of those stations were carrying out what I would have called credible scientific programs. There was an awful lot of basic, mundane, technical data collection going on, which might have been, you know, seismic, or it might have been MET or whatever it was. But there was very, you know, the numbers of stations that you could number them on one hand that were really doing, I thought, groundbreaking science.
And was that because even then, being there was more important than what you were doing whilst you were there?
Well, I mean, it is interesting that the greatest influx of states into the Antarctic happened just at that time of the negotiations of the Antarctic Minerals Convention. And I think there were states that thought, oh my goodness, you know, we don't want to be left out when the cake gets cut up. So, and the fact that they all crowd together there on, you know, King George Island, simply because it is the one point of easiest access. They haven't actually chosen their bases to maximise their, you know, what they can do in terms of science. They've chosen their basis just simply ease of access from Punta Arenas or whatever.
Commuting,
yeah. So that, you know, I mean, to me, you know, Maxwell Bay and Admiralty Bay are sort of like, they're just the dross of Antarctica.
What were the big issues involving Camelot whilst you were in the Foreign Office?
The biggest issue is, I mean, there's always been overfishing for the last few years, particularly on Patagonian toothfish, Dysosticus. Very, very high, lucrative fishery, high-value fish. And we were always suffering from IUU fishing, illegal, unregulated, unrecorded fishing. We actually, and we had a degree of that around South Georgia, so in 93, we actually extended the maritime jurisdiction around South Georgia to 200 miles. And we rapidly brought in very strict regulation of fishing for South Georgia, still under the overall regulation of Camelot. And we managed to bring our own domestic fishery under very tight control and remove illegal fishing. But overall, within the Camelot area, this was a scourge. And I remember my last Camelot meeting. For a fortnight, we sat there arguing with the Russians about their vessels fishing illegally. But it was like arguing that black was red or something. You know, these guys, their morality was somewhere else, you know. It was a big problem. And I think it probably still is a problem. I haven't been in touch with what's going on, you know, in the last few years. But it was an enormous problem of, effectively, one was... And it wasn't just a problem that was going to affect the fishery itself. Of course, if you're fishing in a irresponsible way, you're not too worried about what you're doing in terms of killing off albatrosses. And so incidental catch of seabirds, huge mortality of albatrosses and petrels was always a problem associated with illegal fishing, or actually even with illegal fishing. But we were very, very successful in bringing in stringent measures, often very simple measures, to deal with incidental catch of seabirds. And in the early years, it'd be true to say that even around South Georgia, we were killing actually thousands. By the time I left, I mean, we were down to, I think, 1 year, we killed one Gentoo penguin that happened to literally jump out the water and smash into the side of a fishing vessel. But we had managed to actually remove totally the idea that, well, you know, the actual... There was no mortality of seabirds at all. But the problem continues elsewhere, because obviously sort of South Georgia's, say, black-browed albatrosses, they then get thumped in the waters, say, to the east of Brazil or off Namibia or wherever. So there remains a major problem for seabirds resident in the sub-Antarctic and the Antarctic when they go outside of the area.
Will that ever be solved, or have you recognized?
It's gradually being solved, but, you know, regulation of fisheries in the high seas is a huge problem, and it remains a huge problem. And in certain parts, including the Southwest Atlantic, where there is no regional fisheries organisation, then effectively it's a free-for-all.
Were you concerned about the levels of krill in your time at the
FCA? Well, no, actually at that time it wasn't a problem, and it wasn't perceived as a problem. The interesting thing about krill was that the total allowable catch for krill in the Atlantic sector was, you know, it was of the order, and this is based on the best scientific evidence, that the total allowable catch that could be taken was something like 4.5 million tonnes. Well, you know, we were still only taking a mere hundreds of thousands of tonnes. Mm. But I suspect as global warming kicks in and sea ice becomes less common, the amount of krill around could diminish, which of course will have a knock-on right through the food chain. Because krill, particularly the early stages of krill, very much rely on sea ice presence as a, you know, effectively it's their food supply. It's the algae that grow underneath pack ice that actually sustain krill.
I seem to remember a Tomorrow's World type programme not that many years ago where it was suggesting that human beings might start to consume krill.
Well, it was interesting. There was a major switch in the krill fishery that occurred at the time that the USSR transformed itself into Russia and satellite states. The USSR was fishing krill simply as an industrial take, rather like you'd do, say, sand eels. You'd basically, they're going for fish meal or whatever. And so they were fishing actually quite large amounts of krill in the early 90s. I think, as far as I remember, 400,000 or 500,000 tonnes of the stuff. Very low value, but taking high tonnages. Then, suddenly, when the USSR, well, when Russia realises it's now become more economic and has to actually buy fuel rather than just, you know, the USSR couldn't care less about the fuel, it wasn't part of the economic equation. The take of krill diminished very considerably, and people started catching krill in a much more refined way, and they were taking much smaller quantities of krill and processing them in a very much more careful way. The funny thing was, one of the major products from krill, would you believe, was actually using it for fishing. I mean, you know, angling. There are problems with krill in terms of high fluoride levels and all sorts of other things. Actually, trying to process the stuff, it goes into self-autolysis very rapidly if you don't treat it very quickly. I mean, it literally goes into sort of mush almost, you know, pretty rapidly. And I say it has high fluoride levels. Trying to remove the exoskeleton, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Actually processing it is quite difficult for krill. But undoubtedly, it's a huge protein source if you can actually get your hands on it.
Towards the end.
And aquaculture, of course, is the other big thing. I think as aquaculture develops, people would be wanting a protein source for that more and more and more. And Southern Ocean krill is possibly where they'll go.
Aquaculture, by that I mean fisheries.
Well, fisheries. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's you know, aquaculture in the Far East, which has really taken off, but aquaculture in Northern Hemisphere with salmon or whatever.
Towards the end of your time, we talked earlier about diplomacy that was successful with John Heap, and you were facing a very difficult situation with the Argentinians, who for some reason in 2004, 2005 are beginning to fall out with the rest of the Antarctic presence.
Well, I mean, there's a few instances. I mean, we were under enormous pressure from the early 90s about the sighting of the Antarctic Treaty Secretariat. And this literally did not get resolved until early 2000s. This was actually a huge diplomatic battle that just went on and on and on, with us, I have to say, dragging our feet. Argentina being almost outrageous, but, you know, eventually they won the day because it's one of these situations where I think it was just before the St. Petersburg Antarctic Treaty meeting. The Argentine foreign minister is in London and the Foreign Office sort of comes up, well, what is it we can be nice to the Argentines over? And unfortunately, contrary to my advice, the Antarctic Treaty Secretariat was given away, as far as I'm concerned. I always made the point that effectively you can give something to the Argentines and you don't get anything in return. They will simply ratchet up the next cog and say, and by the way, our next agenda item is X. It wasn't so much on the Antarctic treaty scene that we were falling out over the Argentines, but we certainly were falling out over Southwest Atlantic fisheries. And there was another organisation I was involved in called the Southwest Atlantic Fisheries Commission, which was a bilateral commission just between us and Argentina. So we used to have meetings, I say, revolving twice a year between Buenos Aires and London, discussing the fisheries around the Falklands. Now, under the previous Argentine administration with President Menem, this was working. And de Teller, his foreign secretary, was actually, he had a completely different attitude towards the Falklands, where he felt that he could woo them. Actually, I think it probably was more worrying to the Falkland Islanders to be seduced by an Argentine foreign minister than to actually have one that's trying to kick him in the side of the head, because they don't quite know where they're coming from. Initially, that sort of relationship was working very well, and particularly on the scientific side, these bilateral fisheries commission meetings were actually very productive. There was always a reticence of the Argentines to actually agree at the end of the day how much fish we should have in the Falklands and how much fish they should have. But at least we were talking. And then, I'm afraid, particularly when Kirchner took over as president, things started to go wrong and fisheries came under a lot of pressure. And eventually, it wasn't actually while I was still in the Foreign Office, but very shortly after I left, I think the whole fisheries discussions have gone off the agenda. They are not talking. And it has got progressively worse, I think. So
they're just fishing as much as they like.
Well, you know, I mean, actually, just recently, there was an announcement by the Argentines that they were simply going to fish out Ilex squid before they could get into Falklands waters, because the Ilex basically migrate from Argentine waters where they hatch into Falklands waters, and there's a revolving set of mechanism there. Of course, if you fish out the young Argentine squid, you're causing an enormous amount of damage because you're taking vast amounts of small fish of low value, small squid of low value, and you're doing it quite deliberately, and it's a political, you know, you're doing it, you're actually ruining your own fishery for what the Argentines would regard as a greater political good, which is actually to bring economic pressure onto the Falklands. But it's quite outrageous, really.
If you hadn't happened to retire, what would you have done to save that situation?
Well,
could you have saved that situation?
I don't think you can, basically, because, I mean, that debate, ongoing debate about sovereignty over the Falklands, well, I'm not sure, you know, I say, even in the climate of the Menem de Teller years, it was still difficult. When you then come to the Kirchner presidency, when the Falklands can be used very deliberately by a government which might want to, you know, disguise its own domestic woes, it's a very, very difficult situation. And fish is only one part of the equation. I mean, it's fish, it's tourism, it's charter flights, it's oil, it's everything, quite frankly. It's an almost impossible situation.
What would John Heap have done?
Well, again, I don't think I don't think there is an instant solution. All you can try and do is keep the dialogue going by whatever means you can. But if they slam the door, which is really what they did, it makes, you know, the openings are so much more difficult.
But the door was slammed after you stepped down.
Yes.
So would it have been slammed earlier if you hadn't been there? Were you holding the situation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, because there's so much bigger fish to fry. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, as I say, fish is only one part of the equation. The head of the polar region section is relatively small beer compared with, you know, the overall political situation, which is engaging presidents and foreign secretaries. So, you know, I don't think... It's probably one of these political situations that the Falklands have just got to wear and get through. You never know what will happen downstream.